Hello, and welcome to Off Topic Talk, the show where we talk about interests, hobbies, pastimes, and passions, all the things that we find interesting in life. Please visit the website at offtopictalk.blogspot.com. Welcome to Off Topic Talk. This is show number 5, May 31st, 2006. Today we're going to discuss geocaching, what it is, its history, and how to get involved. In the news, we have a story about the United States government's Waste Isolation Pilot Plant program. In the media discussion, we're going to talk about the film Lucky Number 11. We'll have a new song of the week, and we'll close out the show with another tangential thought. Before we get into the show proper, I just want to let everybody know, here in Michigan, it has been unseasonably warm for most of the last week. We've been getting temperatures up into the low 80, upper 80s to low 90s, and the humidity has been rather high. My house does not have central air conditioning, and this means I've got windows open and I've got fans running, and I do not know what kind of background noise we're going to pick up over the course of the show. So hopefully it won't be too bad, but if you hear any strange buzzes, clicks, or whirs, ignore them as best you can, and I'll do my best to edit them out of the final production. And now, off we go. Geocaching. If you've never heard the word before, you might be scratching your head right now. Geo, generally from geography, being your location or the location of something somewhere on the planet, and caching, the process of hiding something away, a treasure or something that you want to keep hidden. But what is geocaching? In short, geocaching involves the use of a GPS device or a global positioning system device to track down hidden treasure troves that other people have hidden away for you to go out and find. I don't mean literal treasure, pieces of eight, buried treasure, that sort of thing. This is a game. This is a very family-friendly activity anyone can go out and try. Let's get into a little bit of the history before we talk about what it is today. Global positioning technology. This uses small vehicle-mounted or handheld devices which interact with a number of satellites in orbit to determine the current location of the GPS device, typically via longitude and latitude. The GPS device will print out on its screen what your current location is, direction of travel, all sorts of other useful navigational information. Some of the more moderately priced to high-end GPS devices also have mapping technology, so you can look at an actual map and your position on the map. This is very common in cars these days. Geocaching focuses primarily on the smaller handheld devices, many of which do have mapping technology, which again can come in very handy. Until May of the year 2000, the GPS satellites were intentionally sending a degraded signal to civilian GPS devices, greatly limiting their accuracy. This was being done in the name of national security. GPS technology had originally been developed by the Department of Defense for military applications. But on May 2nd of the year 2000, on the order of the President, this selective availability, this degraded signal, was deactivated. This increased the accuracy of civilian GPS devices by an order of magnitude. Where once a GPS might be accurate within about 100 feet or so, you can now be accurate within 10 feet, and the technology has been getting better ever since. I've read accounts of people using handheld GPS devices to be accurate within 2 or 3 feet of their actual location. So what does all of this mean? How does all of this tie into geocaching? A number of enterprising and individuals who were already acquainted with GPS technology started to experiment with the hiding of a stash of little toys in various locations. They would note the location on the GPS they had with them and then post this location information online. Other people would then use their own GPSs to find the stash and note down in a logbook, as well as online, that they had found it. Thus, the game of geocaching was born. By the end of the year 2000, the geocaching.com website was growing fast, and so was the new activity. Media attention had helped bring more people into it, and in September of 2000, while there were only about 75 caches available, today there are more than I can count. I did a quick search and found over 3,800 caches just within 100 miles of Lansing, Michigan. Geocaching has become a worldwide activity, and there are geocaches located in numerous countries all across the world. There are over 11,000 in the UK, Taiwan has over 80, there are over 900 in Spain, more than 400 in Japan, Even Nepal has 7 geocaches listed online. Egypt has 30. The list just goes on and on. Check out geocaching.com. You can do searches of various locations around the globe and get a general view of where they are and just how many there are. Pretty much anywhere you go, you can probably find a cache in the area. This can add some interesting activity to vacations, family trips, business trips. Pretty much anything that takes you out of doors can be combined with geocaching. Do you like to bike ride? Do you like to jog? Do you like to backpack? Do you like to camp? Do you like to go for walks in the evening through your neighborhood? With the ubiquity of geocaches these days, you can probably find a couple almost literally in your own backyard. These days, the basics of the games are as follows. You get a GPS device. These can range from small older models for as little as $50, $60 that you find on eBay, to really fancy high-end units that you can spend up to or more than $1,000 on. Most people can get a good, solid, reliable GPS device for about $100 if you look around a little bit, and I'll have a little bit more information on where you can look in the show notes. Once you have a GPS device, go and visit geocaching.com and do a little bit of reading. They have lots of useful information, tips and hints about what to do to find your first cache, what sort of equipment that you might want to have. Just generally good advice. These folks are the experts, so go check out what they have available before you head out into the wilderness. Once you feel you're comfortable and ready to begin, do a search in your area and pick out a cache to start with. You'll plug the coordinates into your GPS device, and then you'll begin your search. Odds are good, eventually you will find the cache. I have been out a couple of times where it took me more than one time through the area to find it, but most of the time they're fairly simple to find once you have the coordinates and you're used to scrounging through the brush. Once you find the cache, you'll leave a note in the logbook. There's typically going to be a collection of trinkets, little toys, refrigerator magnets, little plastic figures, what have you. So take one with you as a souvenir, and leave one behind for someone else to take. Head on home, and when you get home, log on to the geocaching.com website and note that you found the log, note down anything interesting about it, what you enjoyed about it. This is the short version, folks. There are a lot of interesting variations that people have put up. Multiple cache sites, virtual caches, and travel bugs are just a few. I'm not going to go into much detail on those, other than I think travel bugs are one of the coolest things that I have found while geocaching. A couple bits of advice. Before you head out, review your selected cache carefully. Geocaches come with difficulty ratings and terrain ratings. The difficulty rating determines how well hidden the cache is at the site. Ranging from a white tub sitting out in plain sight on a pile of black dirt, to something so well hidden it could take you a day or more to locate. You might have to solve puzzles or riddles or do some serious exploration to find it once you're on site. Terrain difficulty ranges from an easy walk for anyone. You could almost skateboard or ride or whatever right up to the site, up to needing specialized equipment, four-wheel drive, airplanes, climbing gear, scuba gear, in order to reach the cache site. A couple of years ago, I saw a listing for a cache that was on a sunken boat in Lake Erie. This would not exactly be a quick afternoon outing. You would need lots of very specialized equipment to get to that one. So you can spend hours, days, weeks, months, years out geocaching, searching the countryside, combing the hills, finding caches, and it's a lot of fun. It's a great thing to do with friends, with family, or even on your own. There's no limit to the variation. It's usually a good idea to take at least one other person with you. There are some safety considerations. If you're walking along a trail staring at your GPS, you might trip over a log or walk off the edge of a cliff or something along those lines. So it's not a bad idea to have a friend along, and it is a very social activity. It's a lot of fun to do with a group of people. So maybe after a little while, you've got a few finds under your belt, and you start thinking, I could do this. I could hide things and let other people find them. And this is highly encouraged. Go to the geocaching website again. This is the central point, folks. Geocaching.com website. This is probably the best focal point for all your geocaching information. They'll have a guide there on what to do to hide your first cache. There are a number of factors to take into account. One of the most important: is it legal for you to put the cache on the property that you want to use? Read up before you go out and start hiding your pickle jar full of goodies. Do your research. Don't put something someplace that you don't have access to One of the caches in my area, I was doing some reading, and a couple months after the cache had been placed, I saw online that the City Park Service had come across it and had asked. They hadn't just removed it and thrown it away. They had used the contact information in the cache and gotten a hold of the person who'd hidden it and asked them to move it to another location. The person had hidden it in a place that the Park Service didn't want people walking through and crushing some of the foliage in the area. They were very friendly and very open. They didn't mind having the cache on the property. They just wanted it in a place that finding it would not cause damage to the plant life in the area. The site was moved, and it continues apace. So here we have it. This is the ultimate scavenger hunt. It's family friendly, and it's a great thing to do to get people outdoors and physically active. One of the really neat concepts geocaching promotes is the idea of cache in, trash out. When you head out to find a geocache, bring along a small garbage bag. After you've found the cache and you're on your way back to pick up your car, stop and pick up any litter, any garbage that you see along the way. And that way, when you leave, you can dispose of it properly. You can have a great time outdoors, and you can be environmentally responsible at the same time. This also will tend to make people more ready to have geocaching going on in their area. If geocachers are out there being responsible, picking up after themselves and after others, who can say something bad about that? There's a lot more information at the geocaching website, so make sure you check it out thoroughly. Once you're ready, once you're comfortable, head on out there, find some caches. I cannot describe just how fun this is, so I hope to see some people out in the fields. The United States has a difficult problem. We have a great deal of rather dangerous nuclear waste material that we need to put somewhere that it won't cause a problem for anybody who happens to live in that area. So there are a host of problems related to safe storage, location, coming up with a good place to put the material that it isn't going to cause any trouble for anybody in the here and now. That's not the problem I'm going to discuss today. The problem I'm going to discuss is what happens in 1,000 years, 2,000, 5,000 years. How do we communicate with the people who are going to be around then about what we have buried now? The Department of Energy has plans for the waste that involve burying a large amount of it in deep underground areas that are geologically stable. The stuff that the DOE is burying has a very long half-life. I believe it's about 10,000 years. How do we tell the civilizations that are going to follow us all of those years from now what's buried down there? How do we communicate a message that no one should go digging in these sites for a very, very long time? If you think about how quickly language changes, written and spoken, you'll begin to see the problem. Think about how much just the English language has changed in the last 100 years, 500 years. Imagine more than 2,000 or 3,000 years of change in language. The issue is being addressed. The Department of Energy is developing the Waste Isolation Pilot Plant Passive Institutional Controls System. This system combines a variety of methods to get the message across to our descendants that an area is a bad place to do any digging. The controls being developed are a combination of physical barriers, various language and symbolic warnings located in a variety of places, in and above the ground at the burial site, as well as multiple off-site archival records. The off-site records are going to be readily available, and they will be updated over the course of time. The on-site system consists of a variety of methods. Buildings both on the ground and below the surface, with records in a variety of languages as well as symbology, to warn people away from the area. In addition, there will be types of information disks made of a variety of materials with very low corrosion rates, buried in the ground at various points and various depths around the burial area. The process they're going through looks pretty thorough, and it makes for a very interesting read. So I'll have a couple of links in the show notes so you can pick up some more detailed information on this process. This week's media suggestion. Not long ago, my wife and I went to a local second-run movie theater. We got there late, and the only film that we were able to get in to see was Lucky Number 11, and this was really lucky for us. I hadn't heard of the film before we arrived at the theater, and frankly, I was very surprised. It has an outstanding cast, and speaking frankly, it was a phenomenally entertaining film. The plot is convoluted and fast-paced, so don't leave to get a popcorn refill in the middle of the movie. You'll miss something. It's also a visual feast from a cinematographic perspective. Colors, patterns, backgrounds, sets, everything combines to make an absolutely fabulous backdrop for the film. Everything about this movie just worked. Josh Hartnett is the unflappable Slevin. Lucy Liu turns in a spectacular performance as the budding love interest. Bruce Willis is perfect as the merciless assassin Mr. Goodcat. I cannot say enough good things about the rival crime lords, Morgan Freeman as the boss, and Ben Kingsley as the rabbi. Rounding out an already incredible cast is Stanley Tucci as a hard-nosed detective trying to make sense out of everything. And backing up this phenomenal casting is a group of supporting characters, many of whose faces you'll probably recognize even if you don't catch their names. Everybody does a great job in this film. And what is it all about? It is a massive case of mistaken identity. Poor Slevin has come to visit his buddy Nick, only to find that Nick has skipped town, owing both of the crime bosses lots and lots of money. When goons from both organizations break into Nick's apartment and find Slevin, they make the wrong assumption about who he is, and our hero suddenly finds himself drawn into the war between the two crime families. While all of this is going on, Police Detective Brokowski is on his tail trying to figure out who this new player in town is, and to make things even worse, the assassin Goodcat is trying to set him up as the fall guy for whatever his latest job is. It's a spectacularly entertaining film, and it makes a whole bunch of left turns and right turns, and a couple of turns whose direction I don't think there's a name for. By the time this show comes out, it'll probably be available on DVD, so put it into your Netflix queue or go to your local video store and rent the film. I cannot recommend this highly enough. This is one of my new favorite movies. Today's music selection of the week is Liquid Silver from the album Silver by Beth Quist over at the Magnatune record label at magnatune.com. Link to her section will be in the show notes. Beth Quist is an incredibly talented multi-instrumental performer, composer, and singer. Among works to her credit are the lead singer of the Las Vegas production of Cirque du Soleil's Ka. She has over 50 original scores for film, video, dance, and theater credits, as well as being an instructor of piano and vocals. Magnatune describes her style of music as electro-Balkan Indian meets New Age. It's a little bit wordy for me, I just think it's beautiful music. So without any further ado, Liquid Silver by Beth Quist. For today's tangential thought, I want to talk to three people. Just three. What we're going to talk about today is driving, heavy traffic, traffic etiquette, politeness, and generally good manners versus bad manners. The first person I'm going to talk to is you, right there, the one in the fast car. The one who believes that getting one car length further ahead is going to make your day. The one who is unconcerned with what your reckless driving is going to do to the traffic around you. Our roads are already pretty crowded, and it's not getting any easier. Roads are crowded, expressways are exceptionally busy, and since we're in the middle of the construction season, things have been aggravated. People's driving habits seem to get worse as road conditions get worse. It should work the other way around. So, person number one. You're the one who, when you see that traffic merging sign, you get into the lane that's going to close, and you hit the gas, and you get as far up that lane as you can, until the lane ends, and then you stick the nose of your car in between two people who may not be willing to let you in. And they don't want to let you in because you just came racing up at 75 miles an hour, passing a mile of traffic, 2 miles of traffic behind you. You feel you need to be in front because, yeah, that extra half mile of distance is going to make all the difference in the world. Try something a little bit different next time. When you see that sign coming up that says lane ending 1 mile, 2 miles, merge right then and there. Get into the other lane. Turn on your turn signal. If traffic is thick, slow down, turn on the turn signal, and wait to get in. Be a little bit more polite, and maybe we'll have a little less aggravation on the roads. The next person I'm going to talk to is the person in that merging lane. You're the one who's bound and determined not to let anybody in front of you. Because if somebody gets in front of you, it's going to slow you down too much. You're going to be late. You're not going to get where you're going. And your world is going to come to an end because somebody has gotten in front of you. Despite the fact that there are hundreds and thousands of other people already in front of you. If you find yourself in that lane that is still open and people are zipping by you, try not to get frustrated with them. They have their own frustrations to deal with. Ease off the gas. Leave a little bit of room in front of you. Let somebody get in front of your car. If everybody driving in that one lane were to open up some space and let one person in front of them, these traffic slowdowns that seem to go on forever would probably be lessened immeasurably. A little bit of politeness, a little bit of courtesy could make things a lot better for everybody on the road. The last person I want to talk to is you right over there. You're the one who's doing what I think everyone probably should be doing. You're traveling at a reasonable rate of speed. You're leaving plenty of space both in front of and behind your car so that someone can get in front of your car and get out of that passing lane, get out of that lane that's going to be closing soon. Like I just said, if everybody on the road took a couple extra minutes to be a little bit more polite, driving would probably get a little bit less frustrating in a lot of our more congested areas. So, I've spoken to three people. Those three people are me. They are probably everybody listening to this podcast at some point in your driving career. I'm not saying everyone is a bad driver. Most people I know are excellent drivers. I'm saying that every now and then we all get a little frustrated at what's going on the road around us. Sitting in that car, having that protection, that anonymity around us, makes it a little bit easier for us to let our tempers get the better of us. I know that I have done this on more than one occasion. I'm sure my wife would happily chime in and talk about this if she were here. So having put some thought into my wife's feedback, I have now presented that to everyone who happens to listen to this show. Take it a little bit more easy. Take a deep breath. Don't let that person whipping by you aggravate you. Let someone in front of you. Let the traffic flow a little more smoothly. This seems like a small thing, but most of us spend a lot of time in our cars, and it's easy to get frustrated and angry and aggravated, especially if you are in a hurry trying to get somewhere. A couple of minutes probably won't make too much difference. If you're concerned about the time, all right, tomorrow morning, leave a few minutes earlier. Do whatever you can to relieve the stress, be a little bit more relaxed, and the roads will be a much happier, much safer place for all of us. Well, I want to thank everyone for listening. Our transition music this week was Ministry of Clodagh by AMB26, Chorus Part 1 by Autumn Vane, Intro Man by Andrew Bowerman, and 2012 by Beethoven, all available at the podshowmusic.com PodSafe Music Network. Thank you all for listening, and have a safe journey.